From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is a special edition of On Point, taped before an audience at WBUR City Space in Boston. To our guests here and listeners across the country, welcome to On Point. Well, as you can hear, we are here today before a full audience at WBUR City Space public events venue in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, back in 1856, Charles Sumner served as the senator from Massachusetts, and Sumner was an ardent critic of slavery. And in May of that year, South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks attacked Sumner with a cane right inside the U.S. Capitol in Washington. Just 1 month later, in June of 1856, the nascent Republican Party chose its first ever presidential nominee. His name was John C. Fremont. So here we have a nation divided, a charismatic, media-savvy presidential candidate. Or, as my guest today writes, 2020 might as well have been 1856 all over again. And you know my guest. He is Steve Inskeep, host of NPR's Morning Edition and the podcast Up First. Steve has reported from across the nation and around the world since first coming to NPR in 1996. He has received multiple awards for his reporting in Nigeria and as part of NPR's news team covering Iraq, amongst many other places. Steve is also a prolific writer and historian, and he is here to talk with us about his newest book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You know, you don't look anything like I imagined.
You're not the first person to say that.
Your eyes are a bit bluer than I thought.
Ah.
So let's start with the big picture, and then we'll talk about the Fremonts in particular.
Sure.
But 2020, like 1856?
Why? In some ways, yes. One way being that it was a divided nation then. In the 1850s, America was divided north and south. States that had gradually abolished slavery and states that had embraced slavery. One headquarters of the anti-slavery movement was Boston, Massachusetts, home of The Liberator, this very strong abolitionist newspaper. It was a deeply divided time. It was a time of great technological change, a time of great economic change, a time of tremendous expansion and acceleration of the speed of the news media, which is something we can certainly find familiar. And it was also a time of demographic change, which in some ways destabilized the country, which is something we can also relate to.
So let's first for a second just talk about that technological change,
yeah,
because you're talking about the telegraph.
Yeah, yeah. This is something that I read about in books as a kid without understanding really the significance of it until I was doing the research for this book. In 1844, Samuel F. B. Morse strung copper wires on chestnut poles with the bark still on from the U.S. Capitol in Washington to Baltimore, Maryland. And an operator on the Baltimore side was able to send news updates from that year's Democratic National Convention in Baltimore to Washington, where Morse was reading these news updates aloud to an audience at the U.S. Capitol. He was the first news anchor. He was that era's Meghna, actually, is the way that we'd like to think of him.
Well, he later became a little bit anti-immigrant, so maybe not that.
Maybe
that
not exactly.
Era's Meghna.
No, he was a little, yeah, actually a lot.
A lot.
Which is another, by the way, another similarity between then and now. There was this huge nativist movement and this paranoia about foreigners, and not just about them being foreign, but of being practitioners of this strange and alien and threatening religion, Catholicism, which really filled a role in society or was painted in society in a way that Islam is often painted today. But in any event, Samuel F. B. Morse, aside from his political views, was a brilliant inventor. And he demonstrated the telegraph, and people then realized that this was a profound change in the human condition, that you could suddenly know with certainty what was happening just then in another city 50 miles away or 100 or 500 miles away. And within a few years, telegraph wires connected all the major cities in the United States. And it was at the same time that weekly newspapers were becoming daily newspapers, and there was suddenly this simultaneous national conversation, which sounds like it ought to bring America closer together, but did not.
Right. I mean, as you write, Americans found out that maybe they didn't like each other that much.
No, no, absolutely. I mean, they were getting the same news, but filtered through partisan news editors, and Northerners would read one version of Charles Sumner's Caning. And Southerners would read another version of Charles Sumner's Caning. And then they would read how, in the North, where they were horrified by this, they would read how the Southerners were celebrating it. And it drove people farther apart to have this instantaneous reaction and reaction to the reaction all the time.
Yeah. So now to the couple at the heart of your book.
Yeah.
So this is the America that they're coming up in. And it's fascinating to me because we're also talking about the rise of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And of course, the first Republican president one thinks of naturally, president, is Abraham Lincoln, the first great figure in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But Fremont was the first nominee.
He was the first presidential nominee. He was a guy who was the immediate predecessor of Lincoln and who was the first person to try the political strategy that Abraham Lincoln used to win. Fremont, John Charles Fremont, was a great Western explorer, an explorer of the American West at the time of Manifest Destiny, of America's westward expansion. He was also a great self-promoter. He didn't actually discover all that much as an explorer, but he would go back and write best-selling books about his adventures. And he would do that with the assistance of his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, who was the daughter of a very powerful senator. He had come from very modest circumstances. She was very much a part of the Washington elite, and they worked together, made themselves so famous that really his fame, and to a degree her fame, that was his major qualification for being president. Now, this is kind of a strange thing. I mean, this is a guy... he was super famous, and his name was on everything. There would be ships named after, there'd be hotels. There'd be like the Fremont Hotel. And in Ohio, Rutherford B. Hayes, future president, was a young lawyer who got his town of Lower Sandusky, Ohio, named Fremont. So this guy, I mean, it's hard to imagine that a guy whose qualifications are that he's famous and his name is on everything would be a presidential nominee, but it happened once upon a time in America.
Now, Fremont himself was the child of a French immigrant. He was born out of wedlock.
Yeah.
So as you said, modest circumstances to begin with. But how did he... Tell us a little bit more about how he became this nationally known figure through these expeditions to the West.
Yeah, it is a remarkable story. And part of it is just timing, that he managed to be in the right place at the right time and be sent out on these expeditions. But his job, I should say, was publicity. His job was to publicize the West. His father-in-law, Jesse's father, Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, wanted the United States to have a Pacific coast, which it didn't really then. California belonged to Mexico. Oregon was disputed territory between the United States and Britain. There was not a confirmed Pacific coast for the United States. And Senator Benton understood that the U.S. would strengthen its claim to the Pacific coast if there were American settlers there. The more Americans who were there, the stronger the U.S. presence would be. But it was a democracy. You couldn't order people to go. You had to entice them. And Benton, who before he was a senator had been a newspaper man, understood the value of publicity. And his son-in-law's job was to make a lot of news on his way west and to talk to newspapers and to give the impression that U.S. government policy was to support settlement of Oregon, even though that wasn't U.S. government policy. He was just a senator. He wasn't the president. He wasn't the administration. But with the right publicity, this could be done. And his son-in-law, with the help again of Jesse, turned out to be a very talented writer and would come back and write these beautiful lyrical accounts of going over the Rocky Mountains and climbing mountains. And he would package these things really well. Can I tell the story of...
Yes,
okay,
please.
So in 1842...
This is a really good story.
John C. Fremont goes on his first expedition. He hires a bunch of guys, civilians. He's an army lieutenant. He hires a bunch of civilians in St. Louis who actually know what they're doing, which he doesn't really. And he goes along the Oregon Trail. He's supposed to go as far as the Continental Divide in the Rocky Mountains. And he gets there, but it's a pass, and it's kind of not very dramatic. It's kind of boring. And he's a guy who likes excitement. So he looks around and decides he's going to climb the highest mountain that he can find. He takes some of his men. They start going up the mountain. It's August, but he's getting at higher and higher altitudes, so it's getting snowy up there. It seems the peak is very close, and the landscape is getting very rough, so they abandon the mules. They leave behind the mules they'd been riding, and so they also leave behind their supplies and their food and their coats and continue climbing up the mountain and find out that the peak is nowhere near as close as they thought it was. They get stuck on the mountain for a couple of days. They nearly die. Several men nearly tumble off the sides of cliffs. But he manages to get to the top of the mountain, plant an American flag, which is very like the American flag that was planted on the moon in 1969. He plants this American flag on top of this mountain, and he looks around and decides this must be the highest mountain in all of North America. Goes back and puts that in his report, and it becomes part of his fame that he has put the American flag, the flag of civilization, on the highest mountain in all of North America. Later, it would be determined that this was not in the top 100 mountains in North America, but people had not measured the height of the other ones. So it became part of his legend when he ran for president.
So he had a knack for salesmanship.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, we are talking this hour with Steve Inskeep. He's host of NPR's Morning Edition and author of the book Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. We're going to talk more about Jesse when we come back.
Good.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with NPR's Steve Inskeep about his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War.
Do people always applaud when you start talking? Like, you're just walking down the street, you start talking to your kids, and people are like...
No, usually more it's like, boo,
oh,
or who are you?
Yeah.
Or, once again, you look nothing like I imagined. So John Fremont obviously is a character.
Yeah.
But Jesse, I mean, I feel like she's the charismatic one almost.
She is a remarkable individual that I learned a lot about and maybe learned a little bit from in studying her. Jesse Benton Fremont was a woman who grew up, to state the obvious, in a time when gender roles were a lot more strict and the opportunities available to women were a lot less. But it's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's tempting to say she grew up wanting to be a man, wanting to be a boy. And her father, in fact, wanted a boy. His first child had been a daughter. He expected the second one to be a son, you know, law of averages. And so he planned to name the son after his father. It was a daughter, but he was a stubborn guy. So he went ahead and named her after his father, Jesse, with just a slight change of spelling. And she wrote in a memoir about her early life, "My father gave me early the place a son would have had." She trailed after him when he went hunting in Virginia. He'd shoot a bird and put the bird in a bag, and she would carry the limp, warm thing, as she wrote later on. She would follow him to the U.S. Senate when he was on his way to work, and he would leave her in the Library of Congress for safekeeping. She even followed him as a girl repeatedly to what we now call the White House to meet various presidents, starting with Andrew Jackson. So she was extremely engaged in and interested in politics. When she became a teenager, she decided to do that permanently. She wanted to do that permanently. Her schoolmates were being married off, often to much older men. And she went to the one particular wedding at which her 16 or 17-year-old schoolmate was married off to the 40-something ambassador from Russia. Russian interference in that marriage. But no, wait. Wrong story. And she just found it gross. And you can kind of picture why she would. All the bridesmaids were teenage girls, and all the groomsmen were distinguished, much older men. And they were paired off together at one point in the wedding. And so she's on the arm of Senator James Buchanan of Pennsylvania and just finds this whole thing so disgusting that she goes away and cuts off her hair. She cut off her hair. She went to her father and said, "I just want to check out of Washington society and be your assistant." This was the point at which her father said, "Enough, it's time to become a woman, grow your hair back out." She did accept traditional gender roles. She got married. She had children. She stayed home with the kids while her husband was off sometimes for years exploring things.
Picking the 10th largest peak in the West.
Exactly,
yes.
Or the top 100, who knows. But in any case, she at the same time found a way to pursue her political ambitions through him, and found a way to be her father's assistant by working with this man who was assisting him in his vision of settling the West and capturing the Pacific coast.
So she really had the flair for understanding people, right?
Yeah.
And we'll talk in a moment about why John Fremont was selected as the first Republican nominee. But you tell this wonderful story about after he gives his nomination speech, right, in June of 1856... and the crowd, you know, sort of almost politely cheers him on. But then they start raucously cheering.
Yes, we want Jesse.
We want Jesse.
It's an amazing scene that is preserved in a kind of diary entry or account, later account, by a guy who was in the crowd. Thousands of Republicans, they're outside the Fremont House in New York City. John does come to the balcony and says a few words. Nobody can even hear him. He's not a great public speaker. And then they chanted for her. It's a remarkable moment. One thing that it shows is that before that campaign in 1856, Jessie Benton Fremont had made herself famous. She had raised her public profile. She was often a defender of her husband when he was in controversies. Letters written by her would end up in the newspapers. Articles about her would describe her fluency in various languages, talking with ambassadors in Washington and so forth. She was in the news. And then she became a symbol for progressive women. This was a time when women were seeking the right to vote. They didn't have it, but some were seeking it. And it was a time when women who weren't supposed to be involved in politics had found a way to be involved in the anti-slavery movement. It was considered okay for women to be engaged in benevolent causes to help people in need, and slavery could be said to qualify, and they were helping to power the anti-slavery movement, and they seized upon this prominent and accomplished woman as their symbol. And there were roars of approval for Jessie Benton Fremont. Now, candidates did not go out to campaign in the way that they do now. It was considered undignified. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable considering where we are now. It was considered undignified for a presidential candidate to go out and give some kind of a crazy speech, speak profanities or whatever they might do. Considered unimaginable, but there would be huge campaign events, and women began attending these campaign events in special ladies' sections, but they were not even there before. There was something happening in the country, and she became a symbol of all of that.
Right. Well, so she became a symbol of all of that, and as you said, in the midst of the Republican Party being the party of anti-slavery.
Yeah.
Right? But, I mean, this is the thing about John Fremont. that's so fascinating, that he was picked as the nominee because he wasn't as fervently opposed to slavery as other possible nominees were?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Slavery in America is an extraordinarily complicated subject that continually turns back on itself. And one thing to bear in mind about the 1840s and 50s is that most people were racists. I mean, even the people who had better opinions than other people were often racist on some level. And if you were going to have an anti-slavery party, you had to somehow have an anti-slavery party that would appeal for the votes of people who were racists, because there were just so many people with that kind of point of view. If you were an abolitionist, someone who wanted to just get rid of slavery right away, which is what William Lloyd Garrison wanted here in Boston, you were considered an extremist because you were calling for something that seemed to be against the Constitution, and you were also making white voters uncomfortable, because if you were to free millions of slaves, white people would have to live next to millions of free black people, which was not something that a lot of white people wanted to contemplate at that time. And so that was not the position that the Republican Party took. They were the first major national party to have an anti-slavery position, but their view was, we need to contain slavery where it is. We're not going to interfere with it in the South, where they have a constitutional right to do that, but we want to keep it from spreading into the newly opened territories of the American West. And that was the position that the Fremonts took.
What did Frederick Douglass think of that?
Oh,
I mean, he was staunchly, has to be absolute abolition.
Yeah, of course, because he was an escaped slave.
Exactly, right.
And he and called it like it was, so he's perfectly willing to say, what is the matter with you people? This is a fascinating story as well, and something that I feel is really relevant to now. We're in the middle of a Democratic primary in which Democrats are trying to decide, do I want, you know, Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden? And what you're asking there is, do I want to go for radical change or some change or a different level of change? Elizabeth Warren versus Amy Klobuchar. I mean, that's the kind of divide that you're looking at. And Frederick Douglass faced that decision in the 1850s. His starting point was, I don't want to be involved in politics at all. Mm-hmm. William Lloyd Garrison here in Boston considered the entire political system to be so corrupt that his job was to be outside of it, denouncing it, not endorsing candidates. Frederick Douglass, escaped slave, anti-slavery orator and author, began as an acolyte of Garrison, but gradually became interested in politics, supported abolitionist candidates, but they're like radical third-party candidates, never going to win. In 1856, Douglass decided that the Republican Party, although it was not abolitionist, was good enough and different enough to move America in the right direction. And he changed the endorsement of the newspaper that he ran from an abolitionist candidate to John Charles Fremont. He was interested in John. He was interested in Jesse. He was publishing articles about both of them. And he decided that this was the way to strike a blow against slavery. And it turned out to be a strategically brilliant move. He was a part of the formation of this party that 4 years later would elect Abraham Lincoln. And they would take a civil war, but that party would be in power in 1865 when slavery was abolished by constitutional amendment. Mm.
Strategically brilliant, even though it was the next Republican who was elected.
Yeah, 1856 was a defeat, which is another thing that I want you to keep in mind as we think about this history and what it can teach us about now, is that politics is a long game. In 1856, the Republicans, the anti-slavery party, they were defeated by the Democrats, who were a much more pro-slavery party. John Charles Fremont was defeated by Senator James Buchanan, and ambassador and secretary of state, many other things, defeated by James Buchanan in 1856, who went on to be, in the estimation of many historians, the worst president in American history. That's a claim to fame of this guy up here. He was defeated by the worst president in American history. Something to have on your tombstone. But they were doing something new in American politics. They had noticed the demographic change in America. The demographic change that was significant then was that the northern states had grown much more rapidly in population than the southern states, and it was now possible, if you did it all correctly, to elect a president with northern votes alone, which is the only way you would ever have an anti-slavery party. Fremont and the Republicans tried that in 1856. They failed, but 4 years later it was Lincoln pursuing that same strategy who, against divided opposition, prevailed. Hmm.
Well, let's circle back to the issue of Catholicism.
Yeah.
Because Fremont wasn't officially a Catholic, right? But he was...
He wasn't at all a Catholic.
He wasn't a Catholic.
No.
But he was pilloried viciously,
yes,
right, by the Democrats.
He was, yeah, this is a remarkable story also. You mentioned earlier that John C. Fremont was the illegitimate son of a French immigrant. His mother was a Virginia aristocrat, by the way, who left her husband to be with this man that she had fallen in love with and never obtained a divorce, which is why John was born out of wedlock. But he was brought up Episcopal, according to everybody's understanding. But when he ran for president in 1856, there was a powerful anti-immigrant movement. And you would like, if you're running for office, you would rather have those anti-immigrant votes than not have those anti-immigrant votes. You know, even if you're the anti-slavery party, there are some nice, you know, anti-immigrant voters who might also not like slavery. You want to go for them. And the opposition understood that. And so the first thing that they did was reveal that he was the illegitimate son of an immigrant. The next thing that they did was they turned him into an immigrant by printing news stories saying he'd been born himself outside the United States. Birthers. And then they went on to say that he was Catholic, because that was the scary thing about the foreigners, was the Catholic foreigners. And this is a very difficult thing to deny, because how do you say what your innermost faith is once somebody has thrown that accusation out at you? Again, I know it is shocking to think of a presidential candidate in America who's described as being born in another country and adhering to a religion that he does not actually follow. But it happened once in 1856, and Fremont ultimately said nothing about it. The campaign prepared a statement for him to make denying that he was Catholic. They didn't do it. They didn't release it. He wouldn't do it. And according to his family, the reason he wouldn't do it is because if he said, "I am Protestant, I'm okay, I can be president," he would be saying, "It is not okay for a Catholic to be president." And he had known a lot of Catholics, and he had served in his expeditions with many Catholics, and he just wasn't going to do that.
In the book, you write that it was arguably the bravest decision of his life.
Yeah.
An act of moral courage.
Yeah, yeah. He had shown a lot of physical courage, also a lot of bizarre and erratic behavior and self-aggrandizing behavior, like risking his men's lives to climb a mountain just so he could have the glory of putting the flag on top. But yeah, this was moral courage. This was accepting unbelievable amounts of abuse and choosing to say nothing because of a principle.
Do you think we saw that?
You're talking about the impeachment vote.
Well, I'm talking about Senator Romney.
Let's talk about Senator Romney, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, the one person who did not vote the way that his party would want him to vote, on Wednesday, the day of the impeachment vote. Senator Romney gave quite a powerful speech. I don't know if you had a chance to hear or listen to it. And he alluded to his faith, and he alluded to the facts as he understood them. And he made his decision knowing the enormous amount of abuse that would be heaped upon him, as it immediately was. And you can say the senator was right, you can say the senator was wrong, but I think that does qualify as an act of moral courage. To look at the facts as you see them. Yeah, go ahead and applaud. It's a hard thing to do. It is clear that there were several other Republican senators who believed essentially the same thing that Senator Romney believed about what the facts were, but were not willing to vote that way. Mm-hmm. You could see their point of view. You could see a senator saying, "He's going to be acquitted anyway, Why would I destroy myself? Why would I self-immolate for no purpose? It is remarkable that Senator Romney decided that even though he knew it would not change the verdict, that he was going to vote the way that he did. It is argued by some, we just had an interview with Adam Schiff, the head Democratic prosecutor. He argued that Romney's vote made a difference, even though it didn't change the verdict, simply because it made the vote somewhat more bipartisan.
One wonders if a century from now, certainly history books will be written that will remark upon that moment.
Entirely possible, yeah.
Well, we are talking with NPR's Steve Inskeep about his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty before a studio audience at WBUR City Space, and we are talking to NPR's Steve Inskeep about his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. So, Steve, I mean, in a sense, in reading your book and learning about the Fremonts, I came away thinking, should I feel hopeful that paranoia, perfidy, celebrity, hucksterism, hate, bigotry have always been sort of part of the American political character?
That's where we're at, that is an optimistic thought, yes.
And yet, but see, still here we are. The nation persists, we advance.
The nation persists, we advance. There is an old saying in politics that in democracy especially, nothing is ever over, which can be a dispiriting thought. Bias and prejudice never really go away. Crazy ideas never really go away. Paranoia never really goes away. Because it's part of human nature, and because new people are always coming into the political system, they're turning 18 or just getting interested at age 45 in politics or whatever it is, there are new people always coming in, and they are attracted to some of the same old arguments, and so we have the same arguments over and over again. That's one of the things that I learn from studying the years before the Civil War and thinking about the stuff that I cover as a news guy during the day or during the early mornings, as it were. But even as we have that same argument again and again and again, we advance, don't we? We would not want to pretend that race relations in the United States are no different today than they were then. We would not want to pretend that the debate over immigration is the same, even. There are these echoes, there are these similar ideas and these similar impulses, and yet somehow, almost in spite of ourselves, we move forward. This book depicts a very dark time when slavery is legal and when immigrants and foreigners are looked down upon and threatened, and when politics is repeatedly becoming violent and the country is coming apart. And it must have seemed very dark to people then in that moment. And yet they were within a few years of a great leap forward for human rights in this country and for the human condition, the abolition of slavery in the United States. It was just around the corner, even though relatively few people at the time could even imagine what it would look like or how it would come about.
Someone wanted to know if the Fremont story gives you hope for America today.
In that way, yes. I try just to take the long view of everything. things may seem really awful right this minute, but they may change, and we may actually be in the process of leaping forward. Frankly, the opposite can also be true. A great moment can be on the verge of something terrible. September 10, 2001. Just to pick a day. Just to pick a day. On September 10, 2001, I was a reporter. I was in Washington. I was covering Congress. There was nothing to lead Morning Edition the next day, September 11. But there was this woman who had just ascended to a leadership position in the House. It was the first time that it happened, I think, or one of the first times that had happened. And so I was supposed to track down this woman and sit with her out in a hallway and talk with her. And so that evening I asked a few questions of Nancy Pelosi and put together a little story to lead Morning Edition the next day because there was no news on September 10, 2001. That story aired the first feed of the program but was supplanted by events later in the day. So things could be really bad tomorrow, let's be frank. But when you take the long view, you understand that a lot of the things that deeply upset us today won't matter 5 minutes from now or 5 hours from now or 5 years from now. And that gives you a different perspective on things.
So the long view, though, tends to smooth out the bumps. Okay.
Yeah.
And the bumps in 1856, 1860, 1861, 1865
yeah.
encompassed
a little Civil War.
The Civil
yeah.
War.
That's a big bump. Yeah.
So a couple questions about that. First of all, in the subtitle of your book, the Fremonts helped cause the Civil
yes.
War.
Yes, and the way that they did was by their participation in the creation of the Republican Party. That's a big part of the story. That's a big part of how the Civil War was triggered. Of course, the original cause was slavery, but the Republican Party is what made it possible to imagine putting slavery on the road to extinction. It was possible because of the demographic change that we discussed earlier. That demographic change is something that the South found profoundly threatening. Republicans are saying, we're going to elect a president with Northern votes alone. Southerners were saying, we're going to be shut out of power. And if that ever happens, we're going to destroy the system. We're going to leave the Union. They threatened to do that in 1856. They backed off because their side won. But we know it was a real threat because in 1860, when Lincoln won, they did secede from the Union and did fire the first shot of the Civil War at Fort Sumter.
What I love about Fremont is that Lincoln goes on to appoint him as being what the in general command of the West,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he goes out and issues a decree to free the enslaved people of Missouri 2 years before the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah.
And Lincoln actually gets mad at him.
Yeah, Lincoln's
like,
undo
that.
Whoa, yeah, hold
We're
on.
We're not ready for that
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, and he wasn't ready for that. It's a remarkable story. Some of the slave states were still part of the Union. Lincoln didn't want to lose their allegiance. He was not ready to be freeing slaves. And Fremont issued this order to free not all slaves, actually, in Missouri, but the slaves of Missouri rebels. So it was a kind of war move to punish people who were on the other side, white people who were on the other side. Lincoln said, can you modify that or take it back? And Fremont was not very good at following orders ever and declined to do it for many weeks. And finally, rather than obey the order, allowed his wife, Jessie, to go back to Washington on the train and tell Lincoln what was what. And she did. And went to the Executive Mansion, as it was often called then, and met face-to-face with Lincoln. And Lincoln said, General Fremont already knows what I want done. But she wanted to talk to him. And she began saying, this order is working out really well in Missouri. This order is playing really well in Europe, where they don't like slavery. It makes the country look really good. You should stick with it. And according to a later letter that Jesse wrote, Lincoln looked at her and said, you are quite a female politician, which he did not seem to mean favorably. And she went away having not convinced him. Her husband still did not modify the order, and so he was eventually fired.
Dear. Well, when I think about the lessons to be drawn from this period of history, again, the fact of the Civil War is what continues to sort of give me pause.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, in 2020, the nation, fortunately, blood has not been spilled yet. But the nation feels at odds, strongly at odds, with itself.
Yeah.
So, for example, just tell us, day in and day out in Washington, in covering Washington, Is the strife as deep as the rest of us feel as we witness it on our television screens and through our radios and newspapers?
It's a pretty bad moment. I'm reluctant to say we're on our way to another civil war. Circumstances are in many ways different. Yeah. But it is a deeply polarizing moment, partly because we are going through a demographic change just as they were in the 1840s and 50s. What's happening today, as many of us in this room know very well, is that certain groups of people, people of color, immigrants, are increasing in population more rapidly than the rest of the country is. That would not in any way be politically destabilizing if they voted, you know, roughly 50-50 between the political parties, but they don't. The growing populations are much more often with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. And so you do have some Republicans, and I don't wish to generalize about all, but you do have some Republicans who see that as a profound threat, that they're going to be shut out of power forever. And this is something that President Trump openly said in his campaign in 2016. He says the quiet part out loud. That's one of his charms. And he said to his supporters, this is our last chance. This is your last chance to save the country. Because if you don't elect me, the Democrats are going to let a bunch of illegal immigrants across the border, legalize them, they're going to vote, and we'll never win again. This is a thing that he said. And he was expressing the fear of a fair number of people. When you have that fear that you're not going to just lose an election but be out of power forever, you're willing to go to extremes. And that's made our politics more extreme. Now that the president is in the White House, we have Democrats who fear being shut out of power forever. They have this confident belief in this demographic change that is in their favor, but they fear that changes in election rules and a president they see as increasingly autocratic is going to change all the rules in such a way that they can never win forever. And so it's an extraordinarily tense time. The media have become even more divisive. The amount of disinformation is remarkable and growing leaps and bounds. There's an article I would recommend to you in The Atlantic by McKay Coppins, who's an excellent reporter, who explored this a little bit simply by setting up a kind of bogus Facebook account to see what kinds of messages he was sent. Text messages apparently are getting to be a huge thing. You're going to be receiving lots and lots of text messages, and they might be from campaigns. They might be conspiracy theories sent to you, and you can't really even tell who sent them.
Yeah,
that's a thing that's coming. This is all really troubling and confusing to people. Although I am trying to keep the long view and be aware that you're exactly right. It's not exactly a civil war yet. And so we want to keep our heads if we can.
One hopes it never becomes that. I mean, let's be frank about it.
Yeah.
I just want to get a little bit of the inside story here for a second. I have to ask. I mean, Mary Louise Kelly, brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, she's been reported from war zones around the world. Mm-hmm. An incredibly talented, rigorous journalist. After she came back from the Secretary of State's office that day, the day of the infamous blank map, did you run into her soon after that?
I saw her a little bit, but she was pretty busy.
How did that all unfold inside of NPR?
Well, I think it gradually became apparent what a remarkable thing it was. I don't want to say a lot more than what NPR has said, what the work is, but there was this encounter. There was this interview. It was a difficult interview. And then there was this incident afterward. And it was decided that that was part of the story, which is a decision you have to make. You talk to sources, and sometimes sources yell at you or say inappropriate things. And this particular cabinet official, Secretary Pompeo, has spoken to journalists in various ways, including me, frankly. And you decide, is this part of the story or is it not? In this case, it seemed to be so remarkable that it revealed something about the man that you're covering. And so it ended up being part of the story. I don't think that anybody realized, however, what a vast explosion of interest across the country that there would be in this until after it happened. I think that in the moment, I wasn't part of that decision, but I suspect that in the moment, people were simply trying to tell the true story.
Right. You know, one of the downsides to that, that the event that happened after the interview became part of the story, is that the interview is actually amazing. Mm-hmm. Her interview of the secretary, the second half, when she, the precision of her questions around Ukraine are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And you learn a lot about the secretary's position by his unwillingness and inability to answer her yeah. very precise question. Yeah. So I recommend everyone to go back and listen to it, because his behavior afterwards took over the news cycle, but you learn quite a bit about the position of this cabinet member through the last 5 or 6 minutes of her interview.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story that we can understand a little better thanks to the reporting of my colleague, Michelle Kellerman.
Right.
She's our diplomatic correspondent. She's great. She was also in the news briefly because she was kept off of the secretary's trip to Ukraine the other day. But she's continued reporting very professionally. And she offered some really interesting insight into what was happening with the Secretary of State. Marie-Louise Yovanovitch, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, was removed after a smear campaign, recalled by the president, which he had the power to do, although there were questions about why he was doing it to this person who was a victim of inaccurate smears. Secretary Pompeo, according to Michelle Kellerman's reporting, appeared to have quietly tried to defend her, but never in public, because if he did anything in public, it would cross the president, which he never does. And then he's in this interview. He did not want to be asked about Ukraine because he can't answer right. this question. He attempted to manage the interview to get her to agree not to ask about Ukraine. She declined, and this is in writing, by the way, that would be the one of the subjects of the interview. Then he's asked the question, can you name an occasion on which you have defended this person? He could have answered the question. He could have said, listen, I privately did all I could, but this is ultimately the president's decision. From all we know, that might well have been a truthful answer to the question, but he did not choose to answer the question. He simply said something generic like, I always defend all of our people, which is one of the ways, I don't know how he came to that answer, but it's one of the ways that people are trained not to answer questions. Mm-hmm. In this case, we had a correspondent who was not willing to take no answer for an answer.
Right.
And so she asked several times, and he stopped the interview.
Right. Well, we have just a minute or two left, Steve, and I'd like to just finish by circling back to the Fremonts, because we've got a great question from the audience here. So quite simply, someone wants to know, what was the most important or insightful thing you learned from researching the story of the Fremonts?
I think that the long view of history that we've been describing is one thing. There's something a little more intimate, too, and that's just that this is a story of a marriage. Imperfect union refers to both the country at the time and this marriage. They were both ambitious people. I think in some ways it was a difficult marriage. They spent such great, enormous times apart. She loved him very deeply. My mom read this book and decided that he didn't love her very much at all. I'm a journalist. I'm reluctant to make such a strong conclusion, but I'm not going to question my mom. And it just makes you think about the relationships in your own life and the people that you love, and you want to look after them, and you want to try to balance your ambition with your family and with everything else that's important to you in life. It just makes you think a little bit about that.
Well, the book is Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. Steve Inskeep, it's been a real delight. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you to everybody here at the WBUR City Space Public Convening Center. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Yeah.